A warm welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in. It's good to have you here. I am your host, Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. And you can find us worldwide, of course, where internet is available anyway, through our website, redicecreations.com. Up there we have news, forums, newsletter, a member section with our entire radio archive, films, and we have a live stream coming soon too, so stay tuned to redicecreations.com. Alright, our guest today is Neil Kramer. He is behind a blog called The Cleaver, with some pretty interesting articles on it, and we have a few things, so to speak, here on the menu. Seeding consciousness, the imagination, self-actualization, and eschatology. You can find Neil's blog at thecleaver.blogspot.com, where you can find a lot more of his very interesting writings. And Neil wrote a pretty interesting article about rebooting the planet with a connection to the 2012 date that was pretty interesting. And that will take us nicely into the topic of eschatology, of course, but one thing at a time here. So let's begin to say welcome to our guest. Hi, Neil. Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio.
Hello to you, Henrik, and thank you very much for having me here.
It's good to have you. You know, thank you for coming on. You know, I would like to kind of begin talk a little bit about your blog, I guess, and basically when you started it up, and I guess even what you know, what spawned you in the beginning to start it. You know.
Sure. Well, I've been contributing to various websites and articles and essays and stuff on the internet for, I don't know, the last 4 or 5 years, and a friend of mine suggested that I should consider putting these thoughts and ideas into one place. And I think as the technology developed to a point where it was quite easy to set that up without being able to, you know, have to sit there and kind of code anything, the blog route sounded quite interesting, because I was under the impression that it was kind of a diarying tool, which is not really what I was trying to do. I didn't want to create a journal.
Yeah.
But it did give me the ability to put some of my ideas forward and, you know, post sort of hopefully quite well thought out and reasoned arguments and observations, and of course to share that with people. That was the whole point of it.
Yeah.
So I started that up back in sort of middle of 2006, last year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was May time, something like that. And usually I post one or two articles a month, and you know, I get a lot of emails and comments and so on, which are usually pretty positive. So it was just really a way to participate a little bit more in you know, this sort of alternative community, and the, you know, people who were on one side looking at the New World Order and conspiratorial messages.
Yeah.
And on the other side, people who were interested in consciousness and new sciences and new technology and ancient civilization. So it was my attempt to say, well, there's a point where all these things meet, and I'd like to, you know, put forth my humble ideas on those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's an interesting point, and a very good point, that there is a connection between the two, and I think it's important to recognize that. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things I've mentioned to other people in the past is I've been very wary to get too far down the kind of you know, negativity route, where if you do, you know, peel back the sort of first layers of the world, the first thing you see is that it is indeed controlled by a kind of unelected, you know, shadow group of people.
Yeah.
And I think it's a mistake if people stay on that path and just continue to, you know, unravel that endlessly and go into all the millions of, you know, shenanigans that these guys get up to. So my view has been, well, that's important to understand that, and it's important that researchers are out there doing that work. On the other hand, the people I've most enjoyed reading and listening to and learning from are those who actually offer something as a positive, as a solution, and as an alternative way of thinking and approaching things. So that's where the conspiracy moves away from problems to actually moving away to some answers and to some, you know, some real kind of possibilities. So
Yeah. People
looking at consciousness and human potential, and also, you know, a lot of ancient wisdom that's kind of locked up in you know, temples and ancient tablets and ancient books and scrolls. And it, I just got the sense that the information and a lot of the answers are kind of all out there. It's there, some of it's on books on the shelves. The most interesting stuff is there to be dug up, but anybody can do it. So as long as you can spare a little bit of time, I felt that some pretty profound information is out there lying around.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the people I were most interested in are the people who'd identified the problem and then gone away and said, well, what can we do about it? Because it's not the sort of issue where you can go away and, you know, raise an army and create a fortress and, you know, storm the gates. It's yeah. not that kind of issue.
I see what you mean.
So, so my attitude is that if you identify how the mechanism works, the next step is then to identify an alternative mechanism to replace it. And most of that starts off in a very kind of Buddhist sense where it is all within. And I kind of realized a long time ago, I had the intuition initially without any information to back it up, that everything that we experience and that is around us is projection from something inside. And it's only been in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years maybe where I can actually back that up with information and, you know, some kind of quite, you know, indisputable science, but also a lot of ancient wisdom as well where, you know, quantum physics begins to describe what, you know, certain cultures knew sort of 40,000 years ago.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And I guess also that recognizing that there is a dark force or a hidden hand behind events on this planet, and recognizing the conspiracy actually is a way into the subject. I mean, it opens up your mind in a way, and you take in possibilities within your mindset that actually, you know, makes you basically open up your eyes, right?
Yeah, definitely. I think that without without the conspiracy element, a lot of kind of Western thinking would be, you know, not sufficiently impacted to bother to do anything about it. If you just said to someone things aren't quite the way they seem and, you know, the world is a mysterious place, they'd think, well, yeah, okay, whatever, and, you know, go back to watching TV. But if you approach it from the angle that, you know, do you realise that the government is unelected? Do you realise that the decisions are made outside of the government?
Yeah.
Do you realise that there is no such thing as money? And so on and so forth. You know, you can at least raise some interesting questions in people's minds. I mean, my first experience was, I think, on the so-called path, in inverted commas, when I was a lot younger in my teens, I was more interested in, I think, what they call kind of self-development and personal development, and interested in just kind of making my mind a bit sharper and, you know, kind of giving myself some therapy just to iron out issues and be able to think more clearly. So my path started off with, you know, looking at things from a philosophical nature and reading people like Nietzsche and Heidegger and Sartre and Schopenhauer and stuff like that. And it kind of progressed onto, you know, it took a sort of 45 degree turn from there and looked at, you know, what people at the time in the sort of 80s were calling the paranormal and the mysterious, you know, kind of phenomena.
Sure.
And then there seemed to be some kind of integration of that into shamanism, which was something that was kind of popped up out of nowhere. And I read some of the works of Carlos Castaneda and was pretty impressed by him. And in subsequent time, I think it's probably fair to say that a lot of his work was a creation, and it was some of it is fictional. However, the content of his six key books was, you know, astonishing in the quality of information in there. So to me, it didn't matter that it wasn't actually, you know, anthropologically correct. The key messages within it were still very important. And that development continued, and I was, you know, quite happy reading books and doing my own thinking and writing occasional pieces that I'd put out there. And two events I would put it down to, one quite a funny one and one quite a serious one, brought about a mental shift that forced me to put more focus and energy into this discovery and this exploration of what's really going on.
Mm.
The first one was the release of the film The Matrix in 1999,
mm.
Which I didn't actually see it straight away because I couldn't take Keanu Reeves seriously.
Really?
As an actor. Somebody said there's an incredible film that's come out starring, you know, X, Y, and Z, and I thought, oh, God, you know, I'm not going to watch that. It sounds terrible.
Mm.
When I did actually get around to seeing it, aside from the effects and the special effects and so on,
mm.
I was astonished at the perfect metaphor that The Matrix had put forward as an idea in the film,
yeah.
What was actually happening in the real world. And I was literally stunned, and I kind of sat there in the chair, and the experience of the film and the story and the action was completely secondary,
yeah.
To my own astonishment that Andy and Larry Wachowski, who put the film together and were responsible for it,
mm-hmm.
had managed to, you know, synthesize what potentially is a very, very complex subject into quite a neat and tidy one-piece film, which mm-hmm. later they expanded to be, you know, three films. So that was a real turning point, and I think it's things like that that were the genesis of the synchro mysticism idea
mm-hmm.
that's put forward by some of your other guests.
Sure,
Jake. And I think that if anybody doubted the sort of credibility and veracity of synchro mysticism, I would point them to go and watch The Matrix and sit down, you know, with a cup of tea and just sit quietly and watch it on your own,
yeah.
uninterrupted,
yeah.
and think about that again. The second thing was the September 11th mega ritual, the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I was actually in France at the time when that occurred, on holiday. And so it was slightly surreal because all the coverage I saw of it was in French. And although I can, go and buy some bread and a glass of wine, I can't get much further than that with the language. So all I could look at was the pictures.
Sheesh.
And, you know, pick out the odd word of commentary.
Mm.
The house I was staying in didn't have any CNN or BBC. It was all just pure French TV.
Mm.
And so I had quite an eerie aspect to it anyway, because I didn't have the familiar language to, you know, that the report was wrapped up in, so heavily in the States and in the UK and in Europe, in native-speaking country. It wasn't like that. It was just foreign language, but with these incredible images, you know, punctuated throughout it. So I think those two events, very, very different in nature, of course, as I say, one quite a flippant one, and one a very, very serious one.
Oh, yeah.
They really raised the bar in the importance of what I was doing, and I realized that what could have been interpreted as quite a selfish, you know, self-evolution process was actually much more significant and much more selfless, in fact, in that I was really trying to figure out what was going on, not for me, but for everybody, basically. And I think certainly from 2002 onwards, there was an explosion of interest and an explosion of intent through the internet, where people from all different angles and all different disciplines were suddenly moved to do something about this, this collapsing paradigm, and say, I've had enough, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Yeah.
So, everybody does something. Some people write books and blogs and, you know, go on lecture tours and stuff, and that was my point where I began to take things a lot more seriously.
Very interesting. Both The Matrix and 9/11 are also things that are, you know, close to my own kind of awakening, process, I guess, so that's very interesting. But what I would like to ask you, considering that you couldn't, understand the language so good regarding the French, coverage of 9/11, what the heck did you... I mean, what did you think about, since you couldn't hear the spin, so to speak, what was going on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know what you mean. I think the thing that was most suspicious about it was, initially when I looked at it, I thought, you know, somebody, it's incredible how anybody's managed to get hold of a plane or, you know, several planes and perform this technically very, very difficult maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was strange, but what was even stranger was that within a very, very short space of time, considering that this happened, you know, AM in the States, was that within 60 to 90 minutes, the connection was being made with a, you know, relatively unheard of to the public, terrorist organization.
Mm-hmm.
And they were showing footage of people jumping up and down and cheering, you know, Arabic people with you know, different colored skin and different types of clothes and carrying rifles, jumping up and down in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt it was a very crude and very unintelligent piece of, you know, journalism. And it
Oh, yeah. Hit
across all the stations. And I thought, this is almost reached the point now, and this was the paradigm shift for me, where the people creating this illusory world and this illusory event, which was not, of course, as it appeared to be, the people creating that can almost not be bothered disguising their treachery to any great degree. So they just put forward a very, very kind of, you know, primary school, elementary school sort of explanation that 90% of people might swallow, but a good proportion knew that it was nonsense. And I was stunned at the level of unintelligence involved in that. So
yeah, I mean, and that came out later, actually. It seems to be that they were showing these kind of pictures all over the world, basically, at least in the Western world. And it came out afterwards that the reporters on some of those clips had actually faked the entire thing. That I've actually asked, basically, they've gone down to some village, I can't remember exactly where this was, it might have actually been in Iraq or Saudi Arabia or somewhere. When they asked them, basically, to, you know,
Saddam statue down, and that was all staged, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. But I mean, directly after 9/11, they said, you know, okay, can you, you know, holler in front of the camera or express joy or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Jeez, it's incredible.
But it was stunningly bad piece of television to be, you know, caught up in. And my feeling was that it was at that point, although I'd long held this suspicion, that news suddenly lost all credibility. Because certainly in Europe, and you'll be aware of this, the BBC is considered to be one of the last bastions of integrity and diligence and conscientiousness in news reporting. And they were some of the worst culprits in skewed non-news, you know. So when I was looking at that, I felt, you know, sick to the stomach, really, that it had happened.
Yeah.
And then also a parallel feeling, which was I felt vindicated in my suspicions of that news was nonsense all along, that I could not really put my finger on. And now I had this very, you know, palpable, you know, event that can now be evidenced clearly, that there were no 19 Arab hijackers. Many of them were reported still alive and, you know, puzzled, walking around Saudi Arabia. And I've still got that BBC news article linked up somewhere. And, you know, all the things we have now discovered about the building and steel temperatures and so on and so forth. So there's hundreds of good websites and hundreds of bad ones, but lots of information on 9/11 that if somebody can be bothered to spend the time to do it, it is clear in the first 15 minutes that something is badly wrong with the official version.
Oh, yeah.
So, as other people have commented, it was actually a surprise to note this gift from the New World Order of such a botched event. So, although in execution it was successful, its effect, its mega ritual effect was successful. But it also served as a gigantic awakening event for all those who were on the edge.
Yeah.
And that seems to be an incredible gift that was given to us.
It's pretty bold of them to do something like this, because, I mean, they have to, if it is true that, you know, they're running supercomputer, what do you call it, that they're running these scripts on how the reality will play out and so forth.
Yes.
I mean, something would in there must suggest that an event like this would actually tip a few people over, so to speak. What do you think?
Yeah, that's right. I know what you mean. If they modelled this on, you know, supercomputers that model all potential outcomes, I think pretty early on, even if you just had 10 people sat around a table, somebody would say, but won't this serve to awaken, you know, those who had suspicions?
Yeah.
Well, okay, we won't do that then.
Yeah.
So for whatever reason, that was considered an acceptable outcome, aside from the other main purposes of it.
Mm. Mm, that's
so, I mean, it's a long description of why I'm here, but I think everybody can relate to those things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, the Matrix is going on for, you know, well, 10 years old or thereabouts since it was actually put together.
Sure.
But it was at that time that I realised, as I say, this was not a personal path. It was a path that everybody is actually on, and some are more aware of it than others. But as I've gone down my path, I've realised that everybody has this same goal, which is to a point of greater awareness and a point of, you know, ultimate transcendence.
Yeah.
And I think that is a natural state of human existence. And although we may look around at some of our fellow human beings and wonder why they aren't interested and why they seem completely, you know, nonplussed by the whole thing, I would suggest that any apathy of that nature is an artificial state of being and is a signal that something has been suppressed in that person. So you do tend to find that those who are deeply uninterested are still pretty plugged into the grid somewhere, whether it's news or, you know, current affairs or popular culture or popular media. And there has to be some disconnect from that before people have the sort of courage to recognize that curiosity and exploration and personal sacrifice and, you know, group collective consciousness is okay. It's normal. That's what everybody really deep down is all about. So I have more faith in people than I used to do, because I realised now there is a good reason why so many people seem so thick and stupid. It's not entirely their fault.
Sure.
There is an active campaign to keep people that way.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, some would say that the 9/11 events was also kind of a signal for the beginning, I guess, of the end, or the apocalypse, basically, or the unveiling, as you refer to it in your article about 2012 and rebooting the planet. And this, of course, really gets us into the topic of eschatology. What do you think about that, that this is a kind of a big signal in that way, that, okay, something actually is coming down or ending at this point, and something new potentially is beginning, you know?
Yes, I think so. And my attitude to, you know, end of the world talk and apocalyptic talk and all that kind of stuff has radically changed in the last 5 years. You know, science and mainstream news tells us that everything happens very slowly and the galaxy moves very slowly and evolution moves very slowly and everything takes millions of years and there's no great surprises in store. People, so just go back to work and carry on and don't worry and, you know, eat crisps and drink beer and watch TV and don't worry about it, you know,
get back to it. Yeah.
In actual fact, when you take a closer look again, you know, giving oneself the time to do these things is always very important. If you do that and take a look, it becomes clear from a biological, from an astronomical, and from an entheogenic point of view. I'll come back to that word in a minute if anyone's not familiar with it. The world doesn't behave in that way. The world is quite a violent, you know, mutational and unexpected place where things move very quickly and history is not the gentle line, the gentle linear yardstick that we've been led to believe. In actual fact, great, you know, incredible events come about that radically change things in a very short space of time. So I think in the 50s, Immanuel Velikovsky gave us the idea that there was some kind of solar event that came about, or certainly a solar system event that radically changed the face of the Earth. And this was a repeatable event that came around and planets got knocked out of orbit and tidal systems were, you know, violently changed.
Yeah.
And so the Earth was remapped within a matter of weeks or months, you know.
Yeah.
So everybody was hugely affected by that. And a lot of the ancients would try and give us their knowledge of this event, which had been built into buildings and structures and pyramids and so on.
Yeah.
So if you want to approach it from that point of view, that is quite end of the world-ish. However, it was really the works of people like Ian Lungold, who was a kind of a Mayan researcher and a guy who was just, you know, generally interested in the mind. And Carl Johan Kalman,
sure,
who brought to my attention the whole idea of the Mayan calendar, which is, you know, probably people are bored of hearing about this. So 5 years ago it was much more interesting, nobody was really that into it, but now many people are aware of it.
Sure.
The key thing that changed my attitude to eschatology, the eschaton being the event at the end of an age or the end of time, and eschatology being the study of final things, the thing that changed my mind to that was the understanding that Ian Lungold and Carl Johan Kalman put forward, which was that the key temples in Mayan civilization, which is the three key ones, the Temple of Inscriptions at Palenque, the Pyramid of the Jaguar at Tikal, and the Pyramid of Kukulcan at Chichen Itza. These represented in their nine layers the calendar, the Mayan calendar, and each layer indeed represented a period of time, if you want to think of it in linear Western terms, and a period of consciousness, if you want to think of it more accurately in the frame of reference that the people who built it were considering at the time. So what we end up with is a model of consciousness where the Mayans mapped those stages and those events to historical time and to linear time as we would know it. So each stage represents a whole kind of raft of human development or galactic development. So to explain that a little bit, one of the early stages would be to do with cellular creation, which lasts, you know, an incredibly long time.
Oh, yeah.
From zero to the creation of cellular life. Kalman was suggesting 16.4 billion years. And his calculations were based on artifacts that the Mayans had left, where they measured time in huge huge units of different measurements, that they had tons and pictons and ketons, and each layer was roughly kind of 20 times shorter than the next one. So the next mammalian development cycle above the cellular one lasted 820 million years. And then there was family and tribal and regional and national and planetary. And it grows and grows and grows until it reaches a point which, you know, is December the 21st, 2012 or thereabouts, where the cycle of individual consciousness moves to a kind of galactic and universal level. So their pinpointing of the time is not the end of the calendar, it's the end of the cycle at the top of the pyramid to say the cycle has been completed. There are more after it, but we're not mapping them because that is where consciousness moves into a whole new level.
Mm-hmm.
Or as Kalman called it, non-dual cosmic consciousness, which is a little bit New Agey. Terence McKenna, he used to refer to that as a singularity, or the point in time where all things that are possible can happen simultaneously. So it's that is the paradigm shift that I think is much more likely, where consciousness jumps to a new level, and depending on your frequency of consciousness, you would experience that in different ways. So if you were a guy who is, you know, living a very straightforward life, it may be an apocalyptic event that comes about and ends your life and ends your consciousness. If you are a serene, highly intelligent guy sat on top of a mountain meditating in a temple in Peru or something, you may have an entirely different experience of that, where the material world dissolves and where consciousness moves, as many researchers describe, into a fourth dimensional density, into a higher vibrational frequency range, which is probably what happens to us every night when we go to sleep. But just on a more permanent basis, this would then come about. And so my belief is that your state of consciousness and your frequency of consciousness will dictate what your experience is. So some people will end up saying, well, nothing happened, it's all the same, I still can't pay my mortgage and life is still, you know, not very good. Other people will hugely leap forward in their personal evolution, and other people will disappear. And although I find that quite, I say that cautiously now, I do feel that there's a lot of work that can back that up. And I did some work in the summer of this year in Glastonbury and in Wiltshire area in the UK, which is the kind of heart of the crop circle phenomena.
Oh, yeah.
Put some bits and pieces of the puzzle together, which helped me understand that. I think the thing most people have such a big problem with is if you're talking about something that is so otherworldly, so difficult to get your head around, how can you think in those non-ordinary reality terms, and how can you relate to it? You know, what does it mean? I don't understand. You know, you're going to have to translate that for me. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is not translatable in that sense. So, you know, there are a number of ways I would suggest people can, you know, go and take a look at a different level of consciousness. One is through meditation, which is an age-old practice. One is through the ingestion of sacred sacraments, sacred medicines. And one is through, you know, what occultists would refer to as astral projection. They all achieve the same thing, which is they shift your frequency of consciousness to a higher level from a third dimensional state to a fourth dimensional state. And once in there, you can take a look and you can understand the symbols and the energies and the new lexicon and the new vocabulary that falls and disseminates from this world. Without that, it's difficult to translate it into a book that you can pick up and sit down and read. It's difficult to discuss. It's one of the things, as Morpheus says to Neo, that, you know, you can't be told what the Matrix is. You have to go and take a look for yourself.
Sure.
And that is certainly my experience with this level of consciousness. It is not something to be discussed for much time. It's not something to bother about too much. You have to step outside of this and go and have a look at it. And dependent on your belief system and dependent on your resources and your bravery, you can choose a number of different means to go and have a look. So I wouldn't, you know... I wouldn't recommend anything across the board to anybody in particular, but there are means to do it. The techniques exist. They are there. So anybody who cares enough can go and have a look and try it for themselves.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree with what you're saying there. It's a very personal thing. And you also mentioned, you know, I guess disappearance of people or a kind of a transcendence in a way. Do you think that that actually dovetails with the idea of the rapture, since we're in within the context of different religions or whatever your, you know, your background is to this, so to speak?
Yes, I think in absence of a strong personal level of consciousness, you become absorbed into a kind of archetypal system of belief. So many kind of channeled works, which I used to think were a bit dubious, but I'm a little bit more sympathetic to these books now, where entities have you know, transmitted information to you know, psychically sensitive people. Many channeled works suggest that if your level of consciousness is low, you become absorbed into Christianity or into, you know, Islam or into Hinduism. And indeed your death experience or your epiphanies will reflect that in their imagery and, you know, in their content. So many people who are firm, you know, devout Catholics, for example, when they die, they will indeed find themselves in, you know, a rapturous, wonderful place. With somebody looking after them and their relatives greeting them and a god looking down happily with them. And the naughty ones will indeed spend an amount of time in an awful, sulfur-ridden, disgusting hellhole. And belief is so powerful and collective consciousness is so instructive in how it creates the world that it can create these whole levels of being that have independent existence. They're not just something that exists In a flimsy imagination. They become probable universes and probable realities. So the danger is if you have no clarity of consciousness and no quality of your own personal consciousness, you end up gravitating towards the dominant archetype realm, and dependent on where you live and who you are and your socio-economic background and so on and so forth, that will be a number of different things. So it is dangerous not to think.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean, and that's a very good point, actually. You kind of gravitate towards someone else's worldview instead of your own, and you're entrapped in a belief system of, let's say, you know, that the end of the world, or that what you described previously with this, basically some term, it's a singularity of consciousness, I guess, that something happens that actually expands beyond everyone's, you know, wildest imagination, basically. And whatever you want to manifest, you can actually become part of that reality or create it. So let's say that that is something that actually is going to happen. Then if you don't have a clear vision of where you want to be, or who you want to be, or where you want to be at, or what kind of experience you want to have, you potentially then could end up in someone else's, and if that is a nightmarish type scenario of an end of the world thing, we're in very big trouble, I guess. You know,
you're in trouble if you can't think for yourself, and if you can't develop your own spiritual vehicle and your own frequency and your own awareness, you're in trouble, and you end up being sucked into someone else's belief. And the belief is not just a mental conjuration of the brain; it is an actual physical, real place, just as physical and real as this. I would suggest that we remind ourselves that we are not our thoughts, we are not our personality, we're not even consciousness. Consciousness is the programming language of the universe. We are consciousness conductors. That's what we do, that's who we are. Consciousness comes through us, it emanates from us. If you switch off your conductivity, if you refuse to be part of the natural cycle, you refuse to think, you refuse to be, then somebody else will subsume you, will consume you, and you will end up for a period, not indefinitely, because I think everything gets to its destination eventually. We are, in principle, indestructible, but you may spend an unpleasant period of time, shall we say, somewhere that you don't want to be. So
as
a modulator.
Until you realize that you are the one who is in control, right?
Correct. We are the creators. We are the ones who are targeted on this planet, because we are the ones who transmit the reality just like everybody else does. If you switch your brain off and you are sucked into the mainstream media illusion, which is so easy to do. I mean, it still gets everybody, including myself, all the time. You know, you just switch the TV on and you realize you're drooling out of your mouth, and your eyes are half shut, and you've been sat there for 45 minutes and quickly turn it off again. It's still capable of doing that. We must understand that we are being used, because we create reality. So if we are manipulated in a certain way, and if we are shaped and modulated in a certain way, then our creation becomes not ours but somebody else's. So the brain is the modulator. The DNA, as I've come to discover personally, is the transmitter receiver for this. So the DNA is our aerials. This was proposed many years ago by lots of different kinds of people.
Sure.
Most recently to me by Jeremy Narby, who wrote a book called The Cosmic Serpent.
Oh yeah.
Which was really his reflections on the discovery that the Indians, that the Native American Indians and the local people that he was dealing with, in fact, they weren't Native American Indians, I can't remember, it's ignorant of me to forget, but the indigenous peoples of the area where he was studying, they ingested a form of dimethyltryptamine, which allowed them to communicate across the jungle and find things, detect water sources, communicate with other shamans who were far away. And this uncanny ability, which was, you know, evidenced over and over and was, you know, not doubted, you know, this guy, Jeremy Narby, just, he couldn't really put it together until he took it himself. And he realized that what it appeared to be doing, and this constant reference to the serpent and to the snake, was not quite the sort of demonic, dark images we get from the New World Order. Instead, in this culture, the snake was actually the DNA double helix spiral, And the shamans understood that it was this aspect of us, as well as it building proteins and doing its functional job for the body, was actually the aerials that could transmit and receive profound information in vast quantities throughout the entire ecosystem, and everything could communicate with everything else, the plants, the trees, the birds, the animals, the sky, the rocks, everything was involved.
Yeah.
Our DNA, that the, you know, 97% or thereabouts that the mainstream science refers to as junk DNA, it's responsible for some of the most incredible psychic activity that can be imagined. The DNA is also the connection to what some people call the Akashic Record, which is the Earth's own history of all events and all things and all thoughts, not only on a global level and on a huge level, but on a very personal level. All dreams, all smells, all moments, all the most intimate things that we all individually experience throughout our life are permanently stored in this Akashic Record,
which is a
vast network of DNA.
It's the log of the machine of the universe, you know.
And every galaxy, and every area, and every universe, and every intelligence has one. And of course, these link together in the same way the internet does to produce all ideas, all events, all things. So nothing is lost. Everything comes to an end, but nothing is lost.
You know, also I read that a while back, the Jeremy Norby's book, the Cosmic Serpent, and
yes.
One thing that was very interesting there actually was how he was told by the natives that he was, I think he was in Bolivia or something like that. I can't remember exactly now.
Yes, I think you're more on the track than I was.
I think it was somewhere in South America anyway. He actually was told by these natives that they were given instruction basically on how to make or produce a form of sedatives with different mixes of the plants down there. And this was amazing because this was actually non-toxic when ingested, but powerful enough to knock out an animal basically so they could, you know, eat it. And this was actually the basis, I think, for what we use in Western medicine for sedatives basically, or some
yes,
kind of...
Yes, that's true, yeah, well remembered, yeah, exactly the case. And also added to that, the native peoples had figured out that the psychoactive chemical component of this brew that they created was not orally active. It didn't, if you drank it, nothing happened.
Yeah, exactly.
So they also found from all the zillions of other plants in the region that certain plants, when taken with an MAO inhibitor, would stop that enzyme in the gut breaking the reaction down and would allow it to happen. And so they mixed two plants together, which could have, you know, how they knew what they were is anybody's guess. But this particular combination of plants, and it's not just ayahuasca, those who are thinking, oh yeah, he's talking about ayahuasca, that's one of them. There are many, many more.
Yeah.
And ayahuasca is a description of potentially a number of different things, a combination of plants, but they always consist of at least some harmaline or harmala alkaloids. And DMT or NN-DMT. And when taken, this profound event, you know, kind of catapults the participant into a completely different layer of reality. You know, they're not tripping, they're not going out of the brains, they're not going mad, it's not druggy stuff. They're simply turning the dial from 3D to 4D. And if your system of reality and your system of navigation is limited, for whatever reasons, you're going to find that a very confusing, strange experience and come back and not really understand it. If you have spent time to clear your mind and to think truly and credibly about your own existence, then it will mean a lot more. So more and more people like David Icke and Graham Hancock are beginning to personally participate in this, and you can read their books and see what they think about it. And when they do, they invariably come back with quite a deep message, which is a personal message from the vine, as some people call it, which provides a connection to the Mother Earth that obviously in the West we lost eons ago. But this specific medicine because that's what it is. This specific medicine, taken in the right setting, in the right place, and that's what it's all about with this thing. It's not something you do in your bedroom at home. It's something you go to take with an ayahuasca expert. Then, in that particular setting, it has much more of a connection to where it comes from, what it means. So it has a hugely cathartic effect on the user, and it cleans them out, and it points them in the right direction, and it gives them a good hiding if they've not been very good, and encouragement if they're doing well. So it's like the ultimate personal, no-bullshit critic that can see transparently through you. So it is a medicine, that's what it is, and just like any other medicine, it's not to be abused, it's not for fun, it's not something you do for kicks.
Yeah.
It is a medicine.
Yeah, that's an important thing to point out, and also that I think there's, as you mentioned, there are different kind of ways to reach this level, and going through that particular experience might not be necessary for everyone, perhaps. You know, you could get there through other means, you know?
Yeah, some people, if you're lucky enough to live in areas where Zen Buddhism is practiced, there are equally effective methods. They require a lot more discipline. They require a lot more effort. But the result is the same thing. It is a shifting of that consciousness level, a shifting of that frequency. So imagine that the thing you are doing is, you know, you're stuck on the 3D frequency all the time. You don't have a dial on a radio that you can move. It's just stuck on that frequency. These practices, these techniques, these medicines, these systems of enlightenment, they exist to create a dial that is on your head. And when you turn the dial, you suddenly have a new station to go to. And you can turn it back again as well, which is helpful. So that's what this thing does. It opens up the mind. It does expand the consciousness, to use that 60s expression. But it expands it in such a way that it is done within a natural context. So you can go and take a look at these things and experience them. So I would recommend people look at the information. I'm not suggesting everyone dives out and heads over to the Amazon to have a go.
Sure.
Look at the information. Yeah. Listen to some of the people from the West who've done it and see what effect it's had. Not just the sacred medicines, but also the meditation techniques. There are many, many Westerners who've gone across on personal journeys to discover meditation and its purpose. It's nothing to do with relaxation. That's a byproduct. That is an epiphenomenon of the main event. The main event is to shift the frequency of consciousness from the habitual 3D realm to another one. That's what it's for.
Yeah, exactly. Very good point. And you know, do you think that this might also connect with the idea that you briefly mentioned by you know, Terence McKenna talked about the time wave zero idea, that potentially we're approaching a point in and around 2012 then again, but that seems to be pointing towards that date, that we could end up in a world where, I guess, dream time and linear time kind of merge or become mixed in some way, or that what
yeah,
we...
Yeah,
you know?
Terence McKenna, you know, kind of began his ascent into the, you know, the annals of philosophical fame as an ethnobotanist. So he would study the plants and the systems of chemicals that ran through them and the relationship between people. So if you take a look at my blog at some point, you'll see that I think my latest sort of article covers some of this, and there's some links to some of the more, you know, esoteric or unusual terms. And so he had approached it from the beginning with access to this medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, some people think, oh yeah, he's a crazy, druggy, long-haired guy, and what's he talking about? If you listen to McKenna speak, which I would definitely advise people go and do, and there are various podcasts that are all in existence and free to download as far as I can gather, and if you go and take a look at my blog, over on the right-hand side there are some links. There's one there to a brilliant podcast by a guy called Lorenzo at the Psychedelic Salon, and he has a lot of McKenna material on there.
Mm-hmm.
What you will find when you listen to McKenna is he's one of the most incredibly articulate and incredibly linguistic people you'll ever meet.
Mm-hmm.
Although you won't meet him because he's not around anymore, but
yeah.
You'll meet him through his words, and you'll meet him through your resonance with them. And he put forward the idea of the time wave, which was an idea that centres around an ebb and flow of novelty, which the universe creates, which when you can determine that to mean a couple of different things, and in my blog I'm just pulling it up to remind myself, I described it as a kind of dynamic creativity in the universe. And this thing comes around and enables us to create, to build, to civilize ourselves, to grow, to develop consciousness, to move, to refine, to do all the things that you would imagine nature would want to do with itself. But this element of the universe has a pattern, as McKenna described, a fractal geometry, which eventually spirals down in the same way that a shell does that you would pick out the beach. When you look at those shells, they spiral in and in and then get to a tiny point. That point in the middle is the singularity.
Yep.
And at the singularity, all novelty is infinitely expressed. And when he mapped out his time wave, which was based, you know, on quite subjective judgments, quite subjective interpretations of history, and when certain inventions came about and civilizations came and fell and systems of thought emerged, this time wave came to an end in, initially it was in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
He revised that when he started to discover the Mayan calendar because it was such an obvious connection. And although he had no knowledge of it when he was developing his time wave theory.
And by the way, that's interesting because that's kind of the other way around, because I know that Kalman, Carl Johan Kalman, actually points towards 28th of October, I think, 2011 as the end point.
Yes, I think it would be wise for anybody who's looking into this to not be specific about the 21st of December 2012. It's not a light switch moment.
Yeah, sure.
It's a crest on a graph. It's the apex of a certain mapped out line. It's not an event where somebody throws a switch and everything changes instantly.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to work like that. You can see the events in progress now, and you can figure out where we're on the line now. That is just a point on a process. It's not something that did not exist that will suddenly come into existence. It is a moment of maximum potential and maximum possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And as McKenna described it, at this concrescence of infinite novelty, all conceivable things will occur simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, at the time, he was not aware of the Mayan calendar. We only have his word for that, but I believe he is a man of his word, so that is okay with me. And when he did discover the Mayan calendar, he realized that there was such a tie-in with what he was doing that he revised his information quite openly and said, there is clearly a connection here. So I try and draw some of the interesting possibilities together in my blog piece about McKenna, about Kalman, about the brilliant Ian Lungold, who's now sadly not with us anymore either.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And what those things mean for eschatology, what they mean for so-called apocalyptic news reporting, to try and clear up what the word apocalypse actually means. So yeah, as ever, I'm really pulling various threads together and then putting my own interpretation on top of those.
Yeah, and you do it very good, very well, I should say. And you know, I want to ask you here: do you have, do you feel like continuing in our subscriber section and continuing this interview there? Because we're actually almost out of time here in the first segment.
Sure. Yes, I'd love to.
All right. Very good. You know what I want to do here, though, before we end off, is that I know that you're writing a book, and I know that you're very, you know, busy with that, keeping up with that. And I also want to leave the floor open in the last few minutes here, just to let you mention your blog, or if there's anything else, you know, you want to leave us with in the first segment here.
Sure. Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Take a look at my blog, which is thecleaver.blogspot.com. Go and have a look. See if you can find anything interesting. I hope you can. certainly lots of the things we've touched on in this hour, mentioned in greater detail. There's a bunch of articles on there this year. There's some going back to last year as well. So everything's still there. It's all free and open. There's no kind of ugly adverts. So hopefully it'll be pleasurable to move around. There is also some links on there to sites that I think have good information and are worth looking at. And if you click on the about me section, you can see a little picture of Patrick Magoo, and that isn't me, it's someone else. And if you click on that, it will give you my email, which you can certainly communicate with me if you wish, and also a book I'm working on at the moment, which I expect will surface in March 2008. If anybody's interested in that, I can pass you information about it and put you on the kind of, you know, first line of receipt. So anybody who wants to take a look at a kind of consolidation of my feelings and thoughts, and that book will hopefully reflect those things. So so that's it.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to talk, and I hope it's been interesting.
Absolutely wonderful. Looking forward to that in March, everybody. And in the meantime, check out thecleaver.blogspot.com. So Neil and I are going to take a little break here, but we'll see you on the other side of this break. So thank you so much for coming on, Neil.
Thank you very much.
Don't miss our subscriber interview with Neil Kramer. We're going to talk more about atheism and how other people's versions of reality is being imprinted in us through the media. We're also going to talk about Abraham Maslow's pyramid of needs and how this connects with the pyramid with the removed capstone, the all-pervasive symbol of the power structure. So don't miss this excellent continuation coming right up in the subscriber section. Head on over to redicecreations.com to find out how to sign up and tune in. Big thanks to Fredrik behind the controls and to you for listening. We will be back on Sunday with Bruce Lipton to talk about the biology of belief. This is Henrik Palmgren. Until next time, all the best and take good care.